Auhea oho e ko ka aha. Inā he kuleana I mua o kea, aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E naoe mai, e malio mai, I lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. I noho I lawa. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 16000673, State v. Williams. Arguing for the petitioner, Emmanuel G. Guerrero. Arguing for the respondent, Chad Kumagai. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Guerrero and Mr. Kumagai. Are you both ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right, Mr. Guerrero, 10 minutes for rebuttal. We'll give you a warning light at that point. Mr. Kumagai, a 5-minute warning in yours. Please proceed.
Thank you. Your Honor, I believe this is State versus Ronaldo Flores.
Oh, I'm sorry. On the call.
Yes.
Oh, the call was
Williams.
Oh, so sorry. Yes. You should argue the Torres case.
I was about to go back sit down.
Even with your amazing advocacy skills, we don't expect you to do it on the fly for either
should
of these.
Recall the case?
Do we need to recall it? Yes, let's do that.
My apologies, Your Honor.
No. Thank you for pointing out.
Case number SCWC 17000226, State v. Torres. Arguing for the petitioner, Emilio G. Guerrero. Arguing for the respondent, Chad Kumagai. Argument on the merits.
Very well. Now you may proceed. Thank you. Thank you for pointing out.
Thank you. May it please the court, Emmanuel Guerrero for the petitioner, defendant appellant, Ronaldo Torres. As we speak, Mr. Torres is in custody at the Saguaro prison in Arizona. The issues before the court, although it involves two constitutional rights, one is a waiver of a jury trial, and the other waiver of the right not to testify. Really, it is one issue. And the issue is the waiver of those constitutional rights. With respect to the jury trial, was it voluntarily given? With respect to the right not to testify, did he even know that he had a right not to testify? Or put in layman's term, the common theme that we all know when we, on an everyday practice, did he know that he had a right to remain silent? With respect to that issue, not only was there no evidence on the record that the defendant was aware of this right, this basic common right, there was no colloquy at all as to whether or not, even if he knew he had this right, whether he was waiving the right voluntarily. It's not as simple as to say, can you run before you walk, or you crawl before you walk. It's a question of knowing a right that you have. And when we go to the jury trial, for example, you'll notice that on the eve of trial, on March 23rd, on the eve of trial, the court at that point was informed that Mr. Torres would be waiving his right to a jury trial. But if you take a look at the record, the court must have been aware of that previously, because if you take a look at record on appeal, 1 of 2, page 88, you'll notice that there was in fact a waiver, a so-called waiver of a jury trial / indictment by the defendant, indicating that he wanted to proceed by trial before a judge.
Mr. Guerrero, what do you say to the ICA's analysis that because his defense was self-defense, he had to testify?
Not necessarily. If you take a look at the opening statement by the defendant, there was one of his defenses was identification. And identification, as you can see by the opening statement on March 23rd, he said, an issue is identification. And self-defense in itself does not necessarily mean that the defendant himself has to say it in open court. There's other means of self-defense. There's a video in this case.
How does the video in any way support a self-defense in this case?
Well,
the video shows him walking up with a gun and pointing it at the complainant's head and then starting to hit him with his fist. How does that show self-defense?
Well, the video shows what it shows, but it does not show what occurred before that. What was in
Well, it does. It shows the defendant walking from on the other side. There's not a single other person in the entire area, and the complainant is just sitting on that seat. It shows everything, unless you're saying something happened a day before or minutes before. I mean, what are you saying?
And
let me just say, if you are saying that, how do you get that evidence in unless the defendant testifies in response to Justice Nakayama's question?
Well, Your Honor, let me just put it to you in this fashion. The record is the record. The video, the testimonial evidence are on the record, but we also have on the record the defense of the witness being one of identification. As a matter of fact, on his motion for judgment of acquittal, he did indicate that there's an issue of identification. But the issue that we have before you today is on the issue of jury trial, the waiver of a jury trial, which is a constitutional right. He may have known what it is, because the trial court was actually pretty thorough on the factors the court was pretty thorough.
I'm very confused about the defense of identification. Didn't your client actually testify that it was him and he approached the CW?
And that is correct.
So how can there be a defense of identification here?
The motion for judgment of acquittal, Your Honor, prior to the defense, and this goes to the issue of his right not to testify. The issue of right to testify negated his defense of identification because he did in fact testify.
Wait.
When he testified, he acknowledged, yes, that's me. I approached him to sell some dope, some weed, some marijuana, pakalolo, and there was some dispute as to what occurred next.
But Tokunaga identified him. He said he identified a person in the photo lineup that, quote, showed the face of the suspect and that looked like the stranger. In addition, he identified security camera videos of the event that were entered into evidence, and he recounted the event, and then he described the person, and he ID'd your person in court.
Yes, and the judgment of acquittal motion was made before the judge, and the judge said, at this point, I'm going to deny it. And then he testified. And when he testified, that put into the judge, because it was a jury waiver, the judge now had to decide whether I believe the defendant or not, whether the defendant's testimony is credible or not credible. And apparently the court made it clear that it's not credible at all. Now, but before we get to that point, it's a constitutional right, whether you testify or not. Tachibana already tells us it's not only when you don't testify that you have to give the warning. It's whether or not you will testify, you have to give that.
But Mr. Pereira, assuming your point is well taken, that where the defendant does decide to testify, nonetheless, it's necessary that prior to the testimony, Tachibana requires, or the the right against self-incrimination requires that the defendant be informed that he has a right not to testify, and that if he doesn't testify, it won't be held against him. So assume that. Nonetheless, in this case, although I guess the security guard couldn't identify, right?
That is correct.
And so from that point of view, perhaps you have some sort of an argument on harmless error, but I'm thinking back to the Tatu case. You may recall this is a case in which the defendant right to visit the scene was violated. It was a constitutional violation that his counsel couldn't visit the scene. However, the court found harmless error because there was a video showing that the defendant came out of the storage room where the theft allegedly took place with a flashlight in his mouth carrying what looked like the stolen objects. So why wouldn't this be very similar? Because you have on tape this kind of altercation that took place with the defendant and also a gun being displayed. So I'm still reaching for how you could contend it was not harmless error. I mean, the failure to give the full Tachibana colloquy.
Well, let's get one thing clear. In this case, there was no Tachibana colloquy.
Yes.
There was none at all.
I'm assuming in this question that there was constitutional error, but I'm asking you again about the harmlessness of it.
Well, Tachibana tells us, and even in Hernandez, I'm sorry I did not cite it. It was published, I believe, late December, where the constitutional right trumps waiver of constitutional rights within the penal rules are trumped by the Constitution. In this particular case, the line of cases resulting in Tachibana tells us that this right to testify or not to testify, in other words, Article 1, Section 10, self-incrimination, as Your Honor just stated, it's a personal right. It is a personal right as opposed to investigation. Investigation is the witness's right to effective assistance of counsel. A personal right that cannot be waived according to this court.
But Justice Wilson's question is a little bit different. He's assuming that there's a constitutional error, but constitutional errors can be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt unless there's structural error. And I don't think any court has adopted that this is structural error. Our courts certainly haven't.
Well, I think at this point, the Lewis case, for example, adopting the footnote 9 of Tachibana tells us that the burden falls on the defendant to establish error at some point, prejudice. Tachibana then tells us no. If the colloquy is defective, not that the colloquy wasn't given, that the colloquy was defective, the burden then shifts on the government. The government, be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. It is then the government's burden. What I'm suggesting to Your Honor is that when a right that is so personal under the Constitution is given, then as I've stated in my application as well as to the ICA, that is error. There is question as to what his defenses were or what his defenses was, but what we do know is this. As soon as he went out, one of his defenses gone, albeit small, self-defense was gone. What we do know is when he went up, he essentially said, yes, that is me. That's me. I may have been justified in what I did, but that's me. A defense is now gone. The purpose of the right to not to testify and the right to testify is so that you can make an informed choice as to how your case will proceed. In this case, he wasn't given that choice. Now, when I look at the right to jury trial, for example, in the Alabato case, I think there were some issues about how much time, how much effect it's going to have on the administration of justice. You're going to put additional burden on the trial judges. That's not the case. That's not the case at all. There's just Tachibana. You can read it. There's a script. As a matter of fact, a change of plea has a script. The jury trial form used in this case, it's not even the same jury trial form that lists the four factors or all the factors to a jury trial. But nevertheless, the court saw that. The trial court must have seen it. Because he took 8 pages to explain that right. And yes, I agree. I look at it. I think the state agrees that he knew what a jury trial was. He knew that it consisted of 12 people that he helps to select. He knew that he has 3 preemptory challenges. He knew that he could help select those people, that they must be unanimous. And this is not like the Lobato case where there's problems with salient facts such as it's a different language. He may have issues with his capacity to understand. What was needed was 2 more questions. 2 more inquiries. 2 more engagement. Mr. Torres, is anyone forcing you or coercing you to give up this right?
Mr. Guerrero, yes, has our cases ever said that the only way information can be evaluated as to whether or not there's a knowing intelligent voluntary waiver has to be based on a question of the court?
Well, Your Honor, it's not necessarily in the form of a question, but it's...
We look at the whole record.
Yes. You take a look at the whole record, Your Honor.
And in this case, it's the defendant twice indicated that he was, this was based on his own will. Isn't there two? I mean, the ICA cited it, and he said, the defendant in response, do you have any questions about what I told you? And the defendant says, no. Do we still go through all the same procedures? The court says, yes. We don't have a jury. And finally, the defendant says, yes, I requested that he not have a jury.
Yes, you were right. And the defendant even said, something to the effect that
you'll be fair and wing. And why isn't that sufficient to establish voluntariness?
Because it does not establish whether or not the defendant himself is making that choice. Or if there's...
It says the defendant uses the word pronoun I. I requested that.
You're correct. He says I. He says me. I agree. I waive it.
Not I agreed.
But,
it says, I request it.
Okay. But there's no question before the defendant whether or not, in fact, his request was truly his request. Because if you take a look at the document, record number 88, there's no attestation by the defense counsel, for example, that this is what he wants.
What are the questions, then, that you feel should have been asked?
I agree that the court did inform him of his right, and I agree that he knew of his rights because the exchange between the defendant and the court is clear. I know what my rights are. There should have been a question similar to that in Tachibana, where the Hernandez case tells us. Ask the question if it's you are the one voluntarily giving it up and that it's not subject to someone else. Perhaps, and I'm not suggesting that this happened, because the record is not there. I'm simply saying, Tachibana, the right to testify, not to testify. Change of plea, for example, Hernandez tells us, there's just one, maybe perhaps 2 more questions. Is anyone forcing you? Anyone threatening you? It's as simple as that. I'm not saying it's as simple as that, but I am saying that it's not too much more of a burden. We've got 8 pages. Half a page more would have made a big difference. Now, on the Tachibana, the reason that this court should take the position that when an error, a constitutional error, is made of this magnitude, we're not talking about a defective Tachibana. We're talking about no Tachibana at all. Similar to Miranda rights, for example. But we're talking about no Tachibana, no Lewis warning. No Tachibana warning. I think at that point, it cannot be, it no longer can be a standard of harmless error, whether it's error or not, whether it's reversible error.
Even if the defendant, for example, in your proposal, you have a videotape where the defendant not only is shown committing the crime, but a videotape of the defendant admitting and confessing to the crime and confessing to a half a dozen people. In your view, the case should be vacated regardless, the conviction.
In a trial proceedings, and Your Honor, I know you've been a circuit court judge, and I've appeared before you before many times. Chief Justice, I've worked alongside with you on opposite end of the federal side. Judge Wilson, likewise. And the roles that we have, the roles that we have under the Constitution, under Hawaii State Constitution, I believe, Section 14, Article 1. I have a responsibility. Well, in this case, it was Barry Saola, and now it's me. I have a responsibility to represent the accused. The state has its responsibility to represent the state, the people. I'm aware. The trial court has a judge to make sure the process is followed. It's not a big burden. It happens. It should happen. What I'm suggesting is this. If there's no colloquy at all, you can't give up something you don't know. I mean, we're not going to come in afterwards and say, hey, it's too bad you didn't know and you testified. Might have made a difference. Maybe not. Your Honor, I thank you very much. I'll return on rebuttal.
Oh, very well. We'll hear from beyond rebuttal then. Mr. Kumagai.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
Good morning.
Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Chad Kumagai for Respondent Appellee, State of Hawaii. Your Honors, there is no question that every defendant in this country has a right not to testify at their own trial. However, respectfully, the petitioner is incorrect when he argues that the standard that must be met on appeal in this case is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Pursuant to Lewis and Montiel, the standards to be applied here when no Lewis colloquy is given is actual prejudice. In other words, that the defendant must show actual prejudice stemming from his decision to testify or not.
But our cases that have said that, and there is language, have always, even though they've actually expressed actual prejudice, have applied a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't dispute that. However, the actual prejudice standard has been articulated several times throughout the Tachibana's progeny over the years.
Mr. Kumagai, could you clarify that? What's the difference between actual prejudice and harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? Another way to say it may be that where you do have error that is not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, could you conclude that there's not actual prejudice?
Well, I think to answer the first part of your question, Justice Wilson, I don't think that the case law in this jurisdiction has really explained exactly what actual prejudice is, especially in this context where there was...
Well, with respect to harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, the standard is whether or not the evidence might have affected. You could say whether you can say beyond a reasonable doubt that the evidence might, whether or not it might have affected the jury's deliberation.
Yes.
That would seem to be a standard that would address actual prejudice, don't you think?
Well, I think the key word in the explanation that you just provided was might. And I think when we're talking about actual prejudice, actual must modify prejudice. So in other words, based on the plain language of that term, I don't believe that there can be speculative types of prejudice.
But how could you ever show prejudice? Because like for a situation, say, where the defendant was never testified in the case, how would you know, first of all, for sure certain what the defendant would have testified, what the cross-examination would have been, what the redirect would have been, how that would, whether there was rebuttal, how would it have affected the jury? I mean, maybe we've used that word not in the most precise manner, but we've always, in other constitutional errors that I'm aware of, have always applied a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. However, I think the distinction with the Lewis and Tachibana colloquies is that the Lewis colloquy is incidental to the ultimate colloquy.
But look what happened here. It was supposed to be incidental, and we got neither.
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor. However, I think the conclusion in Lewis and Montiel is instructive, particularly with respect to Lewis. There was no Lewis colloquy. The defendant testified. The convictions were affirmed. Same with Montiel. The defendant testified. There was a deficient Lewis colloquy. The conviction was affirmed based on that actual prejudice standard. And I think that either way you cut it, in this case, the defendant was not prejudiced by his testimony. As Justice Pollack pointed out, there are multiple times where the complainant identified the defendant, first through a blind sequential lineup, second through his in-court identification, third in the surveillance video, and more than that, State's Exhibit 3, which was entered into evidence through the, I believe the security officer, shows a pretty detailed picture of the defendant and his face.
This is an interesting analysis. Mr. Kumagai, help me with this. Your proposition, I think, is if you imagine a case, this is a case where there's very strong evidence in favor of the prosecution. So if you imagine a case that's very strong for the prosecution, then as a matter of law, it makes no difference whether the defendant receives a Tachibana colloquy. And in fact, in this case, your position is that it would make no difference if the defendant testified in a way that was extremely incriminating. Say the defendant got on the stand and said, I did commit error. And it turns out that his constitutional right was violated. He didn't have a colloquy, and therefore the evidence is clear he wouldn't have testified. So your position is where a defendant does testify, incriminate himself in a situation where he wouldn't have otherwise testified if he'd been advised of his constitutional rights, it doesn't matter. There's no actual prejudice because the government's case is so strong.
Well, I think the matter of prejudice would depend on the substance of the defendant's testimony.
Exactly. So it makes no difference what evidence is provided by the defendant when he testifies in violation of his constitutional right not to testify. It doesn't matter what he says. As long as the government's case is strong enough, then there'd be no actual prejudice. Mm-hmm. I think that's your analysis, right?
No, respectfully, Your Honor. The focus in these types of inquiries, I believe, is what the defendant says.
Would it change your analysis in this case if the defendant said, I did commit the crime? In that case, would you still conclude that his testimony did not constitute actual prejudice?
Yes, I would. I would. That would be my position.
You know, but I think it's a case-by-case situation, right? Yes. And in this case, we don't have a jury trial. We're not speculating as to how his testimony might have affected the decision maker.
Yes.
This is a bench trial. The judge rules. The court found the testimony of Mr. Tokunaga to be credible. The court found the testimony of Mr. Torres not credible. So we have said in bench trials, if, you know, what we have said, that when the judge says they're relying on for perhaps evidence that should not have been admitted, it's beyond a reasonable possibility that that improperly admitted evidence affected the trial. So you can't find that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But in this situation, when we have a judge saying, I find the defendant not credible, I'm not even considering his testimony, where is the prejudice? And if there is prejudice, then why is it not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, thank you, Justice McKenna. The state's position is that the defendant was not prejudiced by his testimony in this case. And essentially, by finding the defendant not credible, the court just didn't consider any of the evidence that Mr. Torres presented, in essence.
And actually, in opening statement, he didn't argue identification. He argued that it was a drug sale.
I think
he never argued identification in opening statement.
Yes, it's more accurate to say that the trial counsel acknowledged that the defendant was in the video. But the true defense theory was self-defense. And that was borne out by Mr. Torres' testimony. And the trial counsel's opening statement, I think, indicates that the trial counsel and the defendant consulted in this case. And the trial counsel knew what Mr. Torres was going to testify to. And I think if we look at Lewis discusses the relationship between the trial counsel and the defendant, and why Tachibana does not apply to the right not to testify.
So let me ask you this. Go ahead.
Okay. Currently, now, you would agree that the right not to testify and the right to testify have equal importance in the Constitution and to defendants, would you not?
I don't know if I would be able to rank certain rights, but there's no question that both rights are personal to the defendant and fundamental rights.
And protected by the Constitution.
That's correct.
In fact, the not to testify is the one that's expressly set forth in the Constitution.
That's correct.
And yet, because even though they have at least equal constitutional stature, it seems we make it easier, our courts make it easier to testify than not to testify by only requiring Tachibana in the situation where the defendant has indicated that he or she does not wish to testify.
Justice Pollack, I agree with you. I think that's an accurate statement. However,
So let me just follow up.
Sure.
One more thing.
Yes.
So in a sense, because we make it easier because we don't require the court to interrogate and question the defendant to make sure that they understand their rights if they choose to testify. And so, in a way, we're almost having a situation that we don't have a level playing field by only requiring the court to inform the defendant when they choose not to testify. We're giving greater protection to one right than the other.
I believe that if this court wanted to have a ultimate colloquy as to the right not to testify, it would have done so in Lewis.
So why could we not do that now prospectively?
I'm not saying that.
And would the state, wouldn't the state would not have any objection to that, right? To informing a defendant of his constitutional rights, requiring the court to do so?
Well, I think there could be an objection on a greater scale. One of Tachibana's objectives was to limit post-conviction proceedings. And respectfully, I don't think that objective has been met, because here we are 20 years later talking about colloquies.
Yes, but think about that. The reason we have it in this case is because we haven't required it. If we required it, we wouldn't have this argument that the defendant might have testified to this or that. In effect, What you're correct. Tachibana said, okay, and the Tachibana situation was a situation where the lawyer had trumped the defendant's wish. So they only protected it because that was the issue. But if we want to eliminate post-conviction or direct challenges on appeal that I would have done this, but I wasn't given the benefit of colloquy, why wouldn't we apply it to both situations prospectively?
Because of the reasons stated by Justice Acoba's decision in Lewis, which are, one, that the defendant has received one or such advisements of the right not to testify.
No, it was Miranda warnings that he mentioned. Do we give Miranda warnings to all defendants who are arrested in this jurisdiction?
I hope that we do.
We do not.
We do not. It's only done when the police wish to take a statement.
Yes, that's what I thought you were referring to.
Right. And so all defendants, the police don't try to elicit a statement, as you know. Oftentimes they don't, especially if there's indictment in situations like that. So I'm wondering how much persuasion that reason has.
Well, if the court's not persuaded by that reason, there are two other reasons.
Go right ahead.
That is that defense counsel would not allow a defendant to take the stand without a full explanation of the right to remain silent and the possible consequences of waiving that right.
Why wouldn't that apply when the defendant chooses to not testify? Why do we assume it in one situation and not the other?
Because, I think that this case is a good example of that, that the trial counsel had to consult with the defendant in order to present a certain defense that they eventually did at trial. And the defendant needed to testify about that. So it seems that trial counsel consulted with the defendant about his right to testify.
So we're relying on speculated off-the-record discussion between the defendant and the lawyer, which we specifically have rejected in one of CJ's opinions, where Gomez-Lobato, where they said, look, we can't just assume because somebody's gone over a form that it's been adequately explained.
Your Honor, I think specifically in this case, I think the indication is there that the trial counsel and the defendant consulted with each other about testimony.
We understand, but we're talking prospectively.
Prospectively?
Right.
Not in this case.
Well, prospectively, I think these reasons could apply in other cases, although maybe there should be a case-by-case analysis.
Don't you think that would reduce post-conviction attacks?
It would reduce Rule 40.
If the judge had given a full advisement regarding the right to testify as well as the right not to testify, would we be here on this issue?
Oh, not on this issue, but right. It's very possible that we'd be talking about the interpretation of the colloquy regarding the right not to testify.
But the state would still argue that if there is a violation, there would still need to be some showing of prejudice before we apply a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard. For example, like what if, a judge was tomorrow in trial, a criminal judge, a judge that completely understands the judge's rights, and a full colloquy was not given. Wouldn't some sort of prejudice have to be shown before we said that it was a structural error and the conviction had to be set aside?
Assuming that those types of facts were borne out by the record that the defendant was a judge.
Or someone that completely, obviously knew the rights.
I think that there might be greater indication that the defendant was aware of his constitutional right to testify or not to testify. And in that case, I think there could be harmless error. But, of course, it would depend on the testimony or lack thereof and other factors in the case. So, Your Honors, I think with respect to the waiver of the defendant's right not to testify and the Lewis colloquy and actual prejudice, I think that Montiel is particularly on point in that respect. So in Montiel, what was at issue was, among other things, the meaning of the term GFE. The police officer said that it meant girlfriend experience. The defendant said that it meant good faith estimate. And I think in that case, actual prejudice, and this is not in the opinion, but I think that it can be gathered from the conclusion that the defendant identified himself as the person who made those statements by saying that GFE means good faith estimate. And I think somewhat of an analogy can be drawn to this case, where the defendant, yes, he acknowledges that he is the person in the video, but his purpose of testifying is to put on his self-defense claim. And so I think in that respect, Montiel is instructive in this case. If we can move on to the waiver of jury trial issue, Your Honors, the courts have always said that we look to a waiver of the right to a jury trial under the totality of the circumstances. And I think that the petitioner's, I guess, statement that there could be this rote colloquy between the defendant and the court is not supported by our case law. I think that the trial court is in the best position to assess whether the defendant is understanding his rights and whether he validly waived them. The trial court has the unique perspective of judging the defendant's demeanor, his understanding, and can ask the appropriate questions that are required of a waiver. And in this case, looking at the record as a whole, it is clear that Mr. Torres wanted to waive his right to a jury trial because of those two points that Justice Pollack pointed out, where the defendant said, I want the bench trial because I think you'll be fairer on the evidence. And later when he says, right, that's what I wanted, referring to the waiver of jury trial or having a bench trial. So on that issue, Your Honors, the ICA did not err in its holding that the waiver was voluntary, knowing, and intelligent. So, Your Honors, what we have here is a almost 20-year precedent now of holding the defendant to an actual prejudice standard on appeal when there has been no Lewis colloquy. The petitioner in this case cannot satisfy that burden, so his convictions must be affirmed. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Kumagai. Mr. Guerrero, your rebuttal.
I think the fact that we have to take a look at is Judge Del Rosario, he's a very experienced judge. I believe he has since retired, but he has done many, many trials, criminal trials. And the issue, again, in this case is was the waiver of personal constitutional right, were they voluntarily waived by the defendant, and did the trial judge make certain that it did in fact happen, that the waiver in fact was voluntarily made. And the jury trial, there seems to be a suggestion that because of the totality of the circumstances test, that there does not need to be a inquiry as to whether or not that decision to waive the jury trial, despite knowing what it is, that there needs to be no inquiry by the court. I would suggest to this court that is not correct. This court has already told us if it's a constitutional right, there must, not only do you need to know, and then you need to know it intelligently, but there needs to be some indication that your waiver of this known right is voluntarily given. That was not done in this case. Tachibana colloquy, or the Lewis colloquy, there's two types. The Lewis, of course, is just the court informing the defendant of his rights. One, to testify. Two, not to testify. And he will, the judge, again, will remind the defendant prior to the close or the close of the state's case. So whether or not the test is actual prejudice or not, we have to go back. Was it given? It wasn't given. So what's the remedy? The state is telling us, regardless of that, it should still be prejudice. I would suggest to this court that the line of cases that we have, because we protect, this court protects individual rights, and rightfully so. The problem is compounded that at the trial, at the close of trial of the state's case, there's no colloquy, there's no advisement at all. I'm not sure why it didn't happen. Record is, we're not there. And as Justice Pollack said, the Tachibana case was a defendant being told by his attorney that, hey, don't testify. And there was a big admonishment by the court that that's not right, and that is pure wrong. Well, in this case, what we have is none of the defendant not being told that he has this right at all. Now, the state wants to tell us that we still have to establish, well, the state can overcome that by the harmless error, because of the evidence presented by the state, the video evidence, testimony of the complainant, testimony of the security officers, recovery of the evidence. That's not what the trial, the fact finder said. The fact finder said, I find him guilty because I don't believe the defendant's testimony to be credible. It's on the transcripts where Judge Del Rosario stated, and I believe Justice McKenna said it on the record, page 2, based on the evidence presented, the court finds the testimony of Mr. Tokunaga to be credible, and the court finds the testimony of Mr. Torres not to be credible. That's prejudice. That's, I don't see how the state can overcome that. And Your Honor, I don't know why. When I read this case, I got this from the trial, after the trial, as appellate counsel. I actually couldn't believe what I was reading. I had to look several times on the transcript. Excuse me, several times on the transcript to make sure I see something which I'm supposed to see, but it's not there. I had to look at it twice, three times, four times. I had to get someone else to take a look at it. I had to call the court reporter to make certain that this is correct. And as a matter of fact, the court reporter pointed out that, hey, the court gave a
Counsel, none of this is in the record.
Okay. I understand, Your Honor. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is it wasn't given. The court tells us it has to be provided because it is a personal right that we have. And to say now that when it's not given, as opposed to being a defective colloquy, when it's not given, that the state can still overcome it because they have evidence, because the guy was found guilty, I think that's just plain wrong. That is just plain wrong, especially in the light of the fact that he testified and his testimony was discredited by the trial judge, the fact finder. If that's not actual prejudice, I don't know what is.
So your position is every time the defendant testifies where defendant hasn't been adequately informed of the right not to testify, that as a matter of law, that constitutes reversible error and it can't be said to be harmless?
At this stage, the law is harmless. But in your scenario, Your Honor, at least he was given the opportunity and the knowledge, about the information, with the knowledge that he has a right to testify or not?
My scenario is meant to pose a situation where there's no advisement of rights, and the defendant testifies. And there's, in your view, just the fact the defendant testifies would mean it's reversible error?
Well, speaking only in Mr. Torres's case, the trial judge made it very clear, I do not find Mr. Torres credible at all. And that is a clear sign and indication. That is a clear sign that there's prejudice. But to answer your question, Your Honor,
it's prejudice because the trial court found him not credible? I'm very confused
about
that.
If he was told of his right not to testify, he would not have testified. It's possible he would not have testified, and he
would have been found not guilty.
I'm not suggesting
when the trial judge found the complaining witness credible.
I'm not suggesting that at all, Your Honor. What I'm suggesting is this: once Mr. Torres testified, it became an issue of who do I believe.
Okay.
Very well. Anything further, Mr. Guerrero, at this point?
I have nothing further. Thank you very much.
Very well. Thank you to both of our attorneys here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Iku iluna, please rise. Ua ho malolo ia mai ne kea aha ho kolo kolo ki hanohano. This Honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.